During the San Antonio meeting, our CME group held a symposium focusing on new developments in the management of triple-negative breast cancer. And prior to the meeting, I met with the keynote speaker for the event, Professor Alan Ashworth, to explore some of the basic science background for this rapidly developing part of breast cancer research. Dr. Ashworth began our conversation by tracing his own research background in the field.
This has been both a scientific and a personal journey of discovery, really, that I got into breast cancer in 1994, 1995, when a friend of mine, Mike Stratton, said he thought there was a second breast cancer gene after BRCA1, and did I want to help him identify it? And at that stage, I hadn't really been overtly involved in cancer research. I was a molecular biologist, good at moving bits of DNA around, I guess. And he asked me to engage in this, and I got very interested in it, and we did indeed find the BRCA2 gene before anybody else. And it kind of changed the way I decided to do my science, because I saw the immediate impact of finding a gene that gave a high risk of breast cancer. In fact, within a week of us finding the gene, there was a woman at the Royal Marsden Hospital scheduled for a prophylactic mastectomy. She was tested for the gene. She didn't have it, and therefore she didn't have the prophylactic mastectomy. And for her, better was her daughters couldn't have the gene as well. So really, it was very important in framing how I wanted to spend the rest of my research career that I decided that I wanted to be involved in something that had that kind of output. And so I started to study the BRCA2 gene and the BRCA1 gene and how they caused cancer. And that led us into the area of DNA repair and how DNA gets fixed when it gets damaged. And the insight that many people made about the same time was that when you have a defective BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene, you're very bad at keeping your DNA intact. And that's what causes mutations, and that's what causes the cancer.
Can you talk about the different mechanisms of DNA repair and what happens with BRCA1 and BRCA2?
Yeah. So there are multiple different types of damage that occurs spontaneously to DNA as a result of the environment of the cell and UV light and others. And multiple pathways have evolved in order to fix those different types of damage. And the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes are involved in a pathway of repair of double strand breaks where both strands of the DNA break very close to each other and essentially the molecule falls apart. This is particularly bad for cells because it doesn't quite know how to fix it properly. And there's a very elaborate mechanism called homologous recombination that fixes some of these double strand breaks, and BRCA2 and BRCA1 are critical for homologous recombination.
What is the nature of the type of damage that cause either homologous or single strand breaks?
So it's not entirely clear, but probably it's to do with when DNA gets copied. It's copied through a replication fork and a very elaborate machinery. This is prone to failure occasionally, and when the replication fork collapses, as it does spontaneously, you sometimes get a double-strand break. So they're probably arising through DNA replication, and the cells got very good at fixing those.
Where does PARP fit in?
So PARP is an enzyme that is involved in a distinct type of DNA repair where you get little single-strand breaks in DNA or modified bases. And PARP's a very active enzyme. It's very abundant in the cell. It binds to damage, and its enzyme activity puts sugars on anything in the vicinity. These polymers of sugars was called PAR, polyADP ribose, and it attaches PAR to itself and to molecules in the vicinity, and they act as a molecular beacon to bring in other components of DNA repair. And so you end up, it's been a critical component of that kind of repair.
What about PARP inhibitors? What do we know about them at a basic level as well as clinically?
Well, PARP inhibitors have been around for 20-odd years. Most of the early ones were not very potent and not very specific. In fact, the PARP enzyme was discovered in the very early 1960s. So all this information has been around. The recent developments have been the development of specific and potent PARP inhibitors that are very active inhibiting the PARP enzyme. And there are multiple different ones, both in scientific and clinical development, and all at different stages.
Can you talk about the ones that are farthest along, and particularly the work that your group has done?
So the one that's probably farthest along at the moment is a drug called olaparib that was originally developed by a biotech company. And we got involved with them with the idea of using these PARP inhibitors in this synthetic lethal strategy to kill BRCA mutant cells. They'd been developing the drug as a potential chemosensitizing agent, the idea being that you damage DNA with chemotherapy and then inhibit its repair with a PARP inhibitor.
And can you talk a little bit about what's been seen? I did interview Andy Tutt about olaparib and the clinical research that has been reported, as well as iniparib, BSI-201, and what we know about that agent.
So Andy's led the phase 2 clinical trials of olaparib, and the phase 1 clinical trials were led by Johan de Bono and Stan Kay in our institution. And from those set of trials, with both established proof of concept, in the sense that shows that the drug can kill BRCA-deficient cells in vivo, and we've also learned a lot about the pharmacology of these agents, to the extent that we can even measure DNA repair processes in people now, as a result of Andy's work in our lab. The BSI-201, or iniparib, seems to have quite distinct properties from olaparib. First of all, chemically, it's distinct and a rather simple molecule, and many people believe that it is a prodrug or it is a metabolite of BSI-201 that's the critical component. Clearly, clinically, it looks very promising in combination with chemotherapy. We know very little about it as a single agent, whether it's active as a single agent.
Does it kind of make more sense to you to combine a PARP inhibitor with chemotherapy, use it alone, or both?
I think it depends on the genetic background of the tumor. And what I believe is that within tumors, there's heterogeneity, and some tumors have what might call a hard defect in homologous recombination / DNA repair. And those will benefit from single-agent PARP inhibitor. Now, triple-negative breast cancer, for example, might have what you might call a soft or minor defect. And there, the best benefit will come from adding in more DNA damage that comes from chemotherapy. So we need to understand more about those two dependencies.
Can you talk a little bit more about the concept of synthetic lethality? It seems to be discussed an awful lot. As you mentioned in your talk today, it's something that's been around for a while. How do you explain it, you know, to your fellows and new trainees?
Well, this is about exploiting defects, genetic defects in tumors. And what synthetic lethality reveals is an underlying linkage between two biochemical pathways. So a defect in one doesn't have any ostensible effects, and then a separate defect in another has no ostensible defects. But when one puts them together, you get this combination or synthesis of lethalities. And that's probably because they're acting in a semi-redundant fashion. One takes over when the other is inhibited, but you inhibit both and the system falls over. One can think about this in electrical circuit terms. You can think of parallel circuits that actually kick in when you block one arm, and that's why neither on its own has any effects. Or you could think about an electrical circuit in series, where reducing one component reduces the flux through the pathway through the circuit, but doesn't block it completely.
Is there any question or controversy about whether any of the known or existing PARP inhibitors, such as the two you mentioned, actually work that way as opposed to maybe through some other mechanism?
Actually, the whole area is full of controversies here, and we believe that it is through synthetic lethality. At least olaparib is through synthetic lethality in a BRCA background. With iniparib plus chemotherapy, there is no real evidence either way. As I said, my belief is that there will be some mild inherent sensitivity, but it's to do with chemopotentiation as well.
Can you talk a little bit about the concept of BRCA-ness and what we know about it, how we test it, and how it applies to triple negative and other breast cancers?
So BRCA-ness is the situation where we have a defect in the pathway of homologous recombination, but not caused by mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2. So there one might expect, in some cases, those tumors phenotypically look like BRCA1 or BRCA2 tumors. And in fact, triple negative tumors look like the tumors that arise in BRCA1 carriers. And that's part of the reason that we developed this concept. The idea that what things look like is caused by an underlying similar genetic effect. So we're still at the stage with BRCA-ness as it being a concept that's more useful for discussing things than it actually is for dividing patients up. But one can imagine assays for BRCA-ness that involved measuring DNA repair processes actually in tumors. And that really would be ultimately the gold standard of how you determine whether somebody might respond to a PARP inhibitor.
So it sounds like we don't have that yet?
We're close. So the work of Nick Turner in my lab just published has come up with an idea of using a marker called RAD51 that gets switched on in response to DNA damage as a marker of homologous recombination. Patients that don't have RAD51 tend to resemble the phenotypes of BRCAnus and look more like triple negative cancers. So if we can implement this in a prospective trial, we think we can validate it and then use it for patient selection.
This is IHC?
This is IF and IHC. And the problem is that you have to damage the tumor 24 hours before you take the biopsy. So you cannot use archival samples.
You have to damage the tumor? How do you
do that? So you do that by giving chemotherapy to the patient. That's one way to do it. One could take the tumor out and then put it into some chemotherapy. We found that's not very reliable. But essentially giving a dose of chemotherapy or a PARP inhibitor and then taking a biopsy 24 hours later might be the way in which to find out whether this pathway is engaged or not.
Can you kind of explain a little bit more about what RAD51 actually is?
Yep. So homologous recombination is a complicated process, and I've already said it requires BRCA1 and BRCA2. RAD51 is a molecule that binds to BRCA1 and BRCA2 that actually carries out the business of repairing the double-strand breaks. And when you irradiate or damage cells, RAD51 forms foci in the nucleus, which are sites of active DNA repair.
What about assays for PARP? I've seen that. I think there was some reported out of Europe with chemotherapy, IHC, cytoplasmic nuclear. What do you think about all that?
So there is a school of thought that levels of PARP might influence response to PARP inhibitor. Now, this might be in a kind of traditional way that that's the target and this is the drug and those two things to go together. I think that's missing the point a bit of what synthetic lethality is. Now, the other side of this coin is PARP is activated by DNA damage, and it might be that PARP levels are a surrogate of cancers that have a DNA repair defect. Now, all the data so far is either preliminary or unpublished, and one would like to see in the fullness of time proper studies that are done in a powered fashion to establish whether PARP levels are related to outcome or response on treatment.
Do you think that's what's going to be shown?
No, I don't think so. But that's my guess. I have no proof for that.
You know, the theme of this meeting tonight is trying to explain things for people who are not necessarily in the lab, which, like I say, is the challenge. You got HCC, RCC, hematologic malignancy, everything just kind of spinning around here. How would you bring in the concept of oncogene addiction? This is something a lot of people hear about. You know, you see examples of it. Does that in any way tie into what you're talking about with synthetic lethality?
Well, I think the two are often confused. And I've seen synthetic lethality used interchangeably with oncogene addiction. Now, to my mind, oncogene addiction is a gain of function mutation generally in a oncogene. So a RAS mutation, a gain-of-function RAS mutation classically, is something to which cancer cells are addicted. If you remove the RAS gene, they die. Now, it's proved very difficult to do that pharmacologically, but that's the principle. Whereas synthetic lethality is targeting a defect in tumors, and so you're hitting a parallel pathway. And I think that's the distinction and that I think is quite important. In effect, you know, they look superficially similar, but there's an important genetic distinction there.
Any sense about what fraction of cancers overall fit the model of oncogene addiction and fit the model in terms of problems with DNA repair?
I think most cancers will have both things going on.
Both.
Actually, both.
Because I've heard a lot of people say the oncogene addiction probably doesn't apply to most cancers.
Well, I think there are, well, it depends on your version of oncogene addiction. I think there are active oncogenes driving cancer in most adult cancer types. They may not be things we can recognize at the moment. Now, the moot point, I guess, is what happens when you inhibit those oncogenes. Does the cancer shrink? And in most cases where one has been able to do that, and the recent exciting results with the Plexicon BRAF inhibitor, I think, again, are proof positive of this. If you find a major driver in cancer and you inhibit it, likely you'll get a response. Now, whether you'll develop resistance quickly is the other issue, and we have seen that again with the BRAF inhibitors. But that doesn't denigrate the fact that it is indeed an oncogene addiction.
And we break, you know, breast cancer down by ER and HER2 subtypes. And even though maybe there'd be more benefit in triple negative, do you think that there will be a way to identify patients with all ER and HER2 subtypes who might benefit from this strategy?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's been neglected so far. I mean, part of the problem was that the BSI-201 trial was in triple negative and it showed clinical benefit. But that doesn't say it wouldn't have shown clinical benefit in ER positive and HER2 positive subgroups. We just don't know. We tended to say that it made scientific sense, therefore that's the case. But actually, you know, I think it's quite likely that some of the highly proliferative ER-positive cancers might well benefit. And we also know from Mark Pegram and Dennis Slayman's work that HER2 levels can affect DNA repair processes as well. That was the original rationale for combining trastuzumab with platinum agents.